So my name is Dan Wallach. I'm a professor at Rice. Kurt Opsahl.
Opsahl, yes.
Is a senior attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Please support them generously with your spare cash.
I certainly do.
And we're here to talk today about academic freedom and responsible disclosure and how it is that we do what we do, being security people who occasionally break things, and how we deal with that in the broader context of our society, which sometimes doesn't get it. So what we thought we'd do is each of us would open up talking for a couple minutes, and then we would throw the floor open, and we encourage you to stand up and rant, no, to stand up and discuss your own experiences, and in particular, the thing that we're looking for is lessons learned. Not, I did this thing and I ended up in jail, and wow, that sucked, but I did this thing, I ended up in jail, and next time I will do X. That's sort of the thing we're hoping to get out of this discussion with everybody. This is being recorded, and which means that you might not want to say anything that would get you in trouble. Okay, when we do questions, because this is being recorded, we have our esteemed helpers running around with microphones. So if you wish to speak, don't just stand up and go, but please instead hold up your hand politely, get the microphone, then go. Okay? Everybody clear on the rules? We'll have fun. Right. So I'm going to start off. I mean, anything else?
That's louder than I thought. Sometimes I get questions which are about legal issues, and this, when you get to the question phase, remember, this is not the forum to ask for legal advice. And if you guys need legal advice from the EFF, that's actually one of the things that we will do bandwidth willing, but another forum is the appropriate place to ask for that. But I'll be happy to talk generally about the law and legal issues.
Yep. Yep. Neither of us are, I mean, he's a lawyer, I'm not a lawyer, but neither of us are your lawyer. And that's important. All right. So I thought I would open up by talking about a somewhat famous experience that Ed Felton, myself, and a bunch of grad students had back in 2000/2001. You see, there was this thing called the SDMI Challenge that stood for the Secure Digital Music Initiative. And it was meant to be a technology to keep kids from copying Britney Spears. And it operated through doing a bunch of signal processing on audio files. They would hide watermarks in the audio that would indicate to compliant devices that this is protected content and you shouldn't pirate it or make copies of it or what have you. Never mind that the whole premise of that is broken. But they decided to have a, quote, public challenge, unquote. And we were able to download a bunch of the audio samples, and we never had to agree to any sort of click wrap. We just downloaded a bunch of samples, and our signal processing wizard students figured out how to remove all the watermarky bits. And we wrote a paper, and we submitted it to the information hiding workshop. And meanwhile, Ed thought it would be good responsible disclosure to let one of the RIAA type people know about it. How'd that work out? It was the right thing to do, but what ended up happening is that shortly before the actual conference, the RIAA had some sort of legal freak out, and the net result was we ended up withdrawing our paper. Information Hiding Workshop wasn't part of some larger organization like ACM or IEEE that could stand up to their defense. The organizers were totally freaked out, and we, the co-authors, were also a little bit freaked out. So we withdrew the paper, and ended up resubmitting it to, at the time, USENIX ATC, and we started talking to the USENIX board, and we started talking to our friends at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And what ultimately happened was really interesting. We sued the RIAA back. There's this wonderful legal thing that I didn't know about until then called a suit for declaratory judgment. And you could explain what this means better than I can, but the broad idea is, let's say you, like, want to, I don't know, pick nuts from my walnut tree. And I say, if you do that, I'll break your nose. And then that threat actually gives you some legal standing to sue me to say that actually I'm allowed to pick them when the tree is on my side of the yard, blah, blah, blah. So that's it's sort of a backwards lawsuit where I'm saying, as if you I'm the plaintiff, you're the defendant, but really we're suing as if you had sued me for the thing. Anyway, it's kind of complicated. That's what we did. the RIAA wrote this letter saying, what, we didn't mean to sue them. What about that threatening letter that they sent, right? Well, anyways, the judge dismissed the lawsuit, but that letter from the RIAA basically gave us carte blanche to publish our paper, and so we did. And that ultimately appeared at USENIX Security 2001, and SDMI, the standard, subsequently died, which probably had nothing to do with us and more to do with 200 companies trying to be a consortium to get anything done at all. So that the big lesson I took from that experience was that it's not that responsible disclosure is good or bad, it's that you have to disclose things to your university lawyers early and often. Because initially, my Rice University lawyers were like, oh, we're not sure about this. But you know, later on when we did the whole Diebold thing, Avi Rubin and I and Adam Stubblefield and Yoshi Kono found all these bugs in the Diebold thing. We were talking to EFF before we did anything at all, and we were talking to our university attorneys well before we went public with anything at all. There was this glorious phone call between Cindy Cohn from the EFF and one of the staff attorneys for my university. I was in on the call, but you know when lawyers can rev up and talk in lawyer geek speak? It's just as incomprehensible to us as when we talk geek speak and nobody else can know it. The Rice attorney was not sold beforehand, and he was totally sold afterwards. Cindy Cohn rocks. Please give money to the EFF. Anyway, so that to me was the big lesson learned, that by the time that the Diebold sent their cease and desist letter, my university's lead counsel looked at it and went, ha, right. So that was really a valuable experience. I mean, so that's my lesson learned. Get your attorneys involved early, and then they'll actually help you. All right, Kurt.
Yes, so I wanted to give an example that we worked on a couple years back, just sort of it seems a little bit pressing because it involved a temporary restraining order that prevented a talk from going forward. And this was the case MBTA versus Anderson. I think some of you at least are familiar with it. In fact, there's a letter from computer security professionals that a number of people in this room signed on to about that case. But I'll still give a little bit of background for those who aren't familiar with it. This was a case of three MIT students who were in Ron Rivest's class, and for that class they had done a paper studying the MyFare system for the Charlie card, the MBTA, Massachusetts Bay Transit Authority's fare card, which actually, as I understand it, is the same kind of card which is used for your room key cards.
Not that I would encourage any of you to compromise the hotel's door lock security system.
Yeah, they get very sensitive. Even at DEF CON, they get sensitive about that one. But this was at DEF CON, so it was a presentation at DEF CON and, called Anatomy of a Subway Hack. And the students actually did speak to the MBTA before giving the presentation and provided them with some information. They were not going to give everything necessary to replicate the attack at the conference, though certainly they were going to talk about it quite openly. And the MBTA panicked. And the Friday of the conference, 2 days before the talk that was scheduled for Sunday, they went to the court after hours and filed a complaint seeking a temporary restraining order to stop the talk. And this is, you know, sort of an interesting strategy to go there after hours. That means you get the duty judge instead of the regular judge. Everything's on kind of a tight time frame. The complaint itself was 30, 40 pages long, so clearly it had been drafted, you know, earlier than that and could have been brought before the time. But in any event, that led to a hearing the next morning, which we, so EFF represented the students and appeared for them telephonically at that hearing in the Boston courthouse. And there was a judge who was faced with, on the one hand, somebody saying, the sky is falling. If this talk goes forward, you know, the MBTA will be ruined. People will be making fare cards willy-nilly. They're about to speak to this group of hackers who will then immediately go about and destroy the MBTA system, which, you know, I didn't think that was actually really true, but that was sort of the fear that was put into the judge. And, you know, we're talking about how, well, this is an incorrect interpretation of the law. I'll just do a brief segue into the legal issue. The primary legal issue was the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. That's the federal anti-hacking statute. And it has a provision in there that talks about transmitting information that does damage to a computer system. And I think when it was drafted, it was thinking about things like viruses and malware. And the MBTA had an interpretation of that, that speaking at a conference was a form of transmitting information. And the result of that information, you know, going to the audience would eventually lead to damage, and so that it was compassed in this. Now, this is, as it turned out, was an incorrect interpretation of the law, but nevertheless, the judge, facing the possibility that the MBTA would be ruined, they went ahead and gave the TRO, and so the talk did not go forward at the conference. And then we spent the next 10 days working to reverse that decision, and we did so when it came up to a preliminary injunction hearing. Unfortunately, not in time for the talk to go forward. A couple of thoughts about this, and for fodder for this discussion. One is I think that this is actually a real example of what I call first contact situations, where an industry that is not used to security professionals, not used to having their flaws exposed, is in the first time faced with a situation in which a security flaw will then become known that previously was not widely known. And this can instill a sense of fear and a sense of panic. And amongst a lot of the security professionals that we deal with, it is well regarded that talking about flaws enhances security. That the flaws exist regardless of whether you talk about them. If there are bad guys who are using them, they're going to continue to use them whether they are talked about at an academic conference or not. And for a lot of companies, they want to provide the sort of the least security they can get away with. They don't want to invest in security if they don't think that that is something that the customer is really going to want, and the customer might not realize that they need to want it unless they know about the flaws. So how did it work out for the MBTA by filing this lawsuit? Well, I mean, we'll never know what would happen if the talk went forward. It probably would have been covered by the security press. There may have been some acknowledgments. Probably very few people would have actually sort of tried to commercialize the hack, as it required thousands of dollars worth of equipment to save yourself a little bit of money on a fare card. And if somebody was trying to do an industrial scale, they probably would get caught through other means. Be that as it may, the talk didn't go forward, and something which would have been relatively minor news in the security community became front page news of the Boston Globe. It was on the TV channels all throughout the Boston area, national media. What they were trying to conceal became very, very widely known. Everybody knew that there was a flaw in their Charlie card system. And not only that, the MyFair car upon which it was based had done research on it. Karsten Knowles had done some extensive work on this. And so if people knew what had previously been done and just thought of the application of trying to say, okay, we'll use that research and use what is already out there and apply that research to the Charlie card, it would not actually be all that hard to replicate the attack. So in terms of security, it wasn't really enhancing their security to do this. So it ended up, I think, being a bad situation for both the researchers and for the company involved. And I think one of the challenges for the community of people who write papers discussing security flaws and want to publish them when they're interacting with companies is making those companies understand that it's actually better for them to let the talk go forward, better for them to fix the flaw in time. If they can't fix it in time, try and work something out. See if the talk can go forward without having critical details that we necessarily replicate it, but work together to cooperatively come to a solution instead of getting all litigious. I think with that, maybe start the discussion.
All right, so again, if you'd like to speak, please wave your hand or walk up to a microphone, and let's get the party started.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Felton, and Dan told a story about one of my adventures. Dan and I have had a number of adventures in this area together. Let me echo a couple things that both of Dan and Kurt said. Kurt talked about first impression, first contact with a company that is involved in some kind of flawed product is very important. The best thing is if you can talk to the security team. They will speak your language. They'll understand that it's a good thing that you're coming to them. And if you come to them in a spirit of genuinely trying to report, hey, you've got a problem, let's talk about how you can fix it, then they can talk to the lawyers and the PR people at the company. And there's some hope that the company will respond productively, constructively. Next best is to talk to the people at the company in a non-public way. This is why something like letting them know, sending them a copy of your paper, sending them an email, hey, here's what we found, is actually really helpful. I'll talk later about another reason why it's a good thing to do that. The worst thing is for them to find out from seeing your talk or from reading your paper on the internet. Because although it sucks to have to withdraw a paper or to face an injunction, it's much worse. It would be much worse to face an actual lawsuit in which someone claims that you have done them irreparable damage. One of the advantages of the situation that we had with SDMI and the RIAA is that we had only our right to publish the paper at stake. Had we done it another way, published the paper and then been sued, it would have been our freedom, it would have been Dan's life savings, it would have been my house on the line. And we were much better, not only legally, but also from a from an optics, public relations point of view, to be fighting for our right to publish, rather than having to defend ourselves against a threat that we had done a lot of damage. When a situation like this happens, your motives will be questioned. Doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter how you've behaved, your motives will be questioned. It's very important to be able to tell a story about how you've behaved responsibly. And the best way to do that is to have actually behaved responsibly and to have actually acted with the correct motives. You cannot bolt this on afterwards. This is it's important from the beginning, even privately, because who knows what kind of subpoena you might get, to be talking about, to be talking constructively, to be not gloating, to be not cackling and saying, ha ha, we could steal a lot of cars with this. We could hack into a lot of accounts with this. There's a way of talking about this which is responsible, which you will do in your paper, but you want to try to do that and be in the right frame of mind yourself privately. It's important to talk to lawyers early on, as Dan said, your own institution's lawyers, places like EFF and others who will help you. You can navigate these situations and, best case, avoid litigation. We've had a number of stories where I think by behaving carefully, we were able to avoid any kind of a legal flare-up. And that's the best case, where you just get to do what you do. Do your research, publish your papers, talk to your colleagues.
So I'm Shane Clark. I work with Kevin Fu, and we've done a lot of work on medical device security. And having spoken to a lot of people at medical device manufacturers since 2008, I think it's important to understand, too, what kind of company you're talking to and what their culture is. Because the first reaction from a lot of medical device manufacturers and vendors is, why would someone do that? Like, why are you even looking at this? That doesn't make any sense. Because they're interested in like the safety and the effectiveness of a device and preserving life. And there's such a huge disconnect there that you can totally miss the fact that you haven't convinced them of anything. Like, they think that you're a crazy person. And that's not true with a company like, you know, Apple or Google, et cetera. But these sort of first contact scenarios, especially for an industry, I think it's important to anticipate what their mindset might be going in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sad but true that the companies in the computer space have more or less got this figured out. And once you get outside of, you know, Microsoft and Google and Mozilla and all that, and you start touching these companies in traditional industries, they tend to take a circle of the wagons approach unless you handle it real carefully.
Thank you.
I would hope that the academic institutions would be supportive of the students. As you say, you know, errors do happen, and there's a lot of wisdom that can come not just from the professors themselves, but from the institution as a whole and its legal counsel. Now, I would say I actually have had a number of really good experiences talking to university counsel about research that has emanated from their university. I mean, in the cases where it is research done by a professor, they have there's really no serious question about whether they will represent the professor and defend their research. But I think more often, seeing that people are being supportive of research that is done by students, you know, in the light of a research project that is part of the institution. But I don't know if that's universal, and I'd like to see more of it.
Hello. I'm academic myself, and I quite understand what academic freedom means. And one of the things you didn't mention is we all want to be the first to do things, and the paper pulled out basically impinged our rights to be first or discovery. However, again, as I said, that I agree with the fact that in the long run, discussing problems and security is helpful for company itself. However, in short run, it may not be. And is there any desire from academic and industrial community to, first of all, agree on the code of conduct? What do you do in this case? Because if it's left to individual, it's dicey. And second, it's fairly simple, in my view, envisage a mechanism when you declare discovery but not disclose it. Right? For example, archive. You can publish paper on archive stating that you did something, and when it comes to open access, it would be a date when you did it and everybody knows priorities. Is there any interest in the academic community, industrial community to do that?
So I think we have a code of conduct, and it's often called responsible disclosure. There wasn't such a concept that was standardized in 2001 when we did the SDMI work, but you know, companies like Microsoft have been aggressively pushing this. You know, responsible disclosure is you give the company a heads up and some timetable that gives them a reasonable amount of time to fix the problems that you found, but not so long that they can sweep it under the rug and ignore it. As an academic who is aware of a problem, you have both a responsibility to the company to help them fix their problem, and you have a responsibility to their users to protect them from the company. And you have to weigh that. If it's the case of you find a bug in the latest version of the Chrome browser, Google can push a fix very quickly. So you, assuming that they can understand it and get the patch together, they're actually pretty good at that, you don't need a huge lead time. On the other hand, I worked with some students at Rice and we found a bug in a door lock system that was used on several of the buildings on campus. That the paper that we wrote about that has still never been made public years later because we simply were unable to get the door lock company to recognize that there might be a problem. And we just gave up, and because it's not that important, so you guys don't get to know about it. But are you shocked that a door lock company that would have problems, right? You know, and instead we just, I think it's a case-by-case basis. Some things you can go public with quickly, some things you can't.
Actually, echo that. Trying to have a responsible disclosure, I mean, is going to be a case-by-case basis. And I've heard of some proposals trying to say, well, there should be like a set number of days or set number, you know, of time periods or processes. And I would hesitate against those kinds of things because what is appropriate will depend upon the circumstances. And there might be something where like the danger to the users is extremely high, and getting information about it to incentivize a fix or to let other people take measures to help themselves will be very important, and this may caution towards going public more quickly. And there'll be other circumstances in which giving plenty of time would be entirely appropriate.
I wanted to go back to the question about academic institutions, and I think the advice I might give from some things that have happened at my own institution are that when you think about first contact, you have to think about your institution too. And so if your institution has never dealt with problems like this or research like this, you have to treat them just like the company. Their first reaction is going to be to freak and to tell you that you're doing something bad and to send your students nastygrams.
Yep.
and all those other things. So I think in the same way that you, you know, the advice about bringing the EFF in and having them talk to your university council, you know, great idea, because I think most of the academic institutions, lawyers in those institutions do not get fired for avoiding lawsuits. And stopping you from doing that kind of work potentially avoids lawsuits. So by their nature, they are very conservative in my experience, and you need to bring them along and educate them and explain to them why it is important that as an academic institution, they support you in doing this research. And you've got to bring them along just like you bring along the companies.
Yep. The curious thing about an academic institution is that they have a lot of money typically in their endowment. And they're very interested in protecting that endowment from a frivolous lawsuit that could take a bunch of it away. But if they get serious about it, they'll spend that money to defend you. So it swings both ways.
I would advise against, asking your institution for permission to publish or to do research. It's ultimately your decision, and you don't want to be in a situation where they're vetting your work. That's not what academic freedom means. They don't necessarily want to be in a position where they're vetting your work, because that puts them on the hook with their deep pockets. And that, by the way, invites a lawsuit. Having someone with deep pockets who has approved your research makes a lawsuit much more likely. So talk to them, get them ready, avoid the freak out, but you also, I think, need to make clear that it's not their decision whether you're going to do the work or publish it.
Let's get a mic back there.
I wanted to share our experience with the disclosure process from the paper published at USENIX Security last year with Alex Halderman and his students on widespread weak keys in network devices. So as part of our disclosure process, we contacted an enormous number of companies because these kinds of problems affected basically everyone on the internet. And so because of that, we have, I think, the closest that I've seen to a study of what happens in the disclosure process. Actually, we probably should. It's not a perfectly uniform sample. So I have the numbers in front of me. We wrote disclosures to 61 companies, and of those, so when the first problem in writing a disclosure is who do you disclose to? So 13 of those companies had some kind of security team contact information available. So of the rest of them, we tried to contact in customer support. We tried anything we could find. Of those 61 companies, a year and a half later, we have received some kind of response that indicates that a human being had read what we wrote to them from 28. So less than half ever got back to us. Which I guess lines up with your problem of if the companies don't acknowledge you, then what do you do as a researcher when you want to publish your paper? Of those companies, I think 14 have now told us that they have fixed the problem in some capacity. Of those 14, six of them have made a public security advisory. So that is 10% of the companies that we try to contact publicly admitted to their customers of their own volition that they had some kind of problem. But actually, it wasn't through their own volition. Of those companies, only two of them proactively went forward and published security advisories without any kind of prompting. The other four of them published security advisories because they were contacted by ICS CERT, the Industrial Control Systems Cyber Emergency Response Team from the US government. So this was one of the lessons that we learned, was actually fairly late in our disclosure process, I think maybe 4 months after we first tried to contact companies, one of the companies contacted ICS CERT to disclose their vulnerability after they'd made a fix. And ICS CERT actually contacted us and asked us to validate their fix and read the disclosure. And at that point, we realized that maybe we should have done all of the disclosures through them, because They had no idea that the problem was much wider than the one company that had tried to contact them. And so we learned that actually, there's US CERT, there's ICS CERT, and many other countries also have some kind of CERT organization. But if you as a security researcher contact CERT, then they have a 45-day disclosure timeline that's sort of automatic. And you can negotiate that with the company as necessary. But this is very useful from the security researcher's point of view because it provides you some protection. Because if the companies agree to work through CERT, then they are bound by the terms that CERT determines. And ICS CERT was extremely helpful because of the six companies that provided disclosures. Four of them only responded to us after CERT contacted them saying, hello, we're the Department of Homeland Security, and you have a a security problem. It was very useful. And also, because they were part of the government and they had done this process a lot of times before, they actually knew who to contact in these companies when it wasn't obvious to us and could get a response. We also had the interesting experience of many of the companies, like some of the examples that we wanted to put on our paper because the problems were particularly egregious. We went through specific efforts to find a human being at the company in order to ensure that we got the correct response. These were big companies. They had well-established security teams with people that we know and respect. And they said, yes, okay, we understand there's problems. They've been fixed. And then 4 months later, when the paper was about to go public, they said, oh my God, no, wait, that's not correct. And we said, but we wrote you exactly what we were going to say. This is, we told you we could factor your keys. These weren't just default keys. And they said, no. And it was a very sad misunderstanding. I don't know how to prevent this kind of thing in the future, because from our perspective, we tried to do everything we could. We found a human being. We explained the problem carefully. We had written a public blog post without naming any names, trying to explain everything that we could. And still, there were misunderstandings. And it was slightly unfortunate, but I think everybody is generally happy now. We have still not published the full list of company names because we don't know. We can't validate the problem, the exact model numbers and company names and everything for every single company who won't respond to us. So the consumers of these companies' products may never know that they are vulnerable. Do you have anything to add? Okay, so I think,
Thank you. So let's see, we have some more hands. There's a hand here. Okay.
I was gonna play devil's advocate and ask you, under what conditions would you yourself decide this is too dangerous to publish?
Wow. I suppose that depends on, what's the downside of the vulnerability being public before the vendor can have a chance to close the hole. I mean, let me be hyperbolic, and let's imagine I figured out how to launch our intercontinental ballistic missiles or something, right? I hope I can't do that. But if I could, that's the sort of vulnerability that you really, really don't want to disclose. Never mind that the same sort of people who are unhappy with Snowden would be unhappy with you, and that's not a good place to be. But there, the downsides of that vulnerability being public are clearly bad. When we're talking about bugs in home Wi-Fi routers, that's an interesting position because a huge number of people are affected, but without putting pressure on the vendors, without public pressure on the vendors, you'll never get it fixed because you can't otherwise reach them. So it's this trade-off of, if I create the public pressure, is that going to cause the fix better than, well, the bad guys already know about it and they might already be exploiting it? So that's the, there's a really complicated trade-off. I don't think, aside from hyperbolic examples, I don't think there's a general purpose metric here. You're balancing harms. If you want to get philosophical about it, you're trying to maximize utility of the entire global population. And, we're all utilitarians now. And that's hard to do, because what's the fitness function of the world?
So I guess this is along the same lines, but what if you encounter a case where there is no
realistic, reasonable fix. So the example before of medical devices, say implanted medical devices where firmware updates are not possible, these devices are in thousands of people and they're not coming out without, you know, major harm to patients. When, and this is not a question to be answered, but I guess, you know, what do people feel is the ethical responsibility there?
Let's see. I'm not a medical guy.
Well, that's just one example.
Right.
Car keys, millions of car keys. Okay. The cost of fixing, of replacing the immobilizers is in the, you know, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars.
Right. So, sir, I mean, I can speak toward voting machines where there was a similar issue. Right? When we were publicizing flaws with voting machines, we were accused of undermining democracy, right? You know, it's no small thing. And I think that the, you know, to be called, that some of the accusations that were thrown at us were quite astonishing. I think that, again, it's this balance of harms. We were explicitly trying to slow the adoption of a technology, that the vendor was incalcitrant and was not going to fix anything. They didn't care. And by we were using the cudgel of public publicity to try to change the market. And I think we actually succeeded in that to some extent. Yeah, please.
So to get back to the question on medical devices, if they're implanted, what do you do? Do you go public with it, with the possibility of harm to patients? What we've done in our case, applying direct public pressure by just going public would not be a good idea, because the patients will get the information, and sometimes it will be hyperbole, and they will refuse treatment because of that, and that could put their life in danger. So what we did, we talked to the medical device companies directly, it's very important to approach them in a non-adversarial way, so develop a relationship with them. They understand that they won't be able to fix the problem directly because the timeline to get a device in out in the market is about 10 years. But they are starting to apply good security architecture principles to their new projects. What happens now is you have a whole bunch of devices that are out there in the field for the next 10 years that will not be they will not be patched. They understand the risks, but at least they know that it's out there, and we are working with them and with, well, the media to try to minimize the hyperbole, so in order to minimize the risks to the patients.
Alan Householder from the CERT Coordination Center. We're still around. We still do vulnerability coordination. We do multi-vendor coordination. So CERT Coordination Center is we're not directly U.S. CERT, we're not directly ICS CERT, we work closely with them, we've coordinate lots of things through both of those organizations. And one of the things that we've absolutely seen this situation where vendors who have recently taken something that didn't used to have a network interface on it and they put a network interface on it, suddenly their threat model has changed dramatically and they didn't notice it. And so they put this thing out there and it's got horrible vulns. I mean, like the just, you know, default passwords and just stupid stuff that you know, most computer companies have known about. You know, they wouldn't have been doing this 15 years ago. It was already known to be stupid 20 years ago. And there's just some really insane things going on when you find something that 5 years ago it was a product that didn't have anything to do with the internet and now suddenly it does. So that's out there a lot. To the point of institutional lawyers, we found, and granted we're CERT, we've been doing this for a while. CMU, who we're a part of, knows we've been doing this for a while. But at the same time, the lawyers, the individual lawyers, you know, will rotate out after a few years and they get new jobs. So we find ourselves very frequently having conversations with our legal counsel that start with them asking us, you're testing software that you don't have a contract to test. Why would you do that? And or even you know, so we frequently have to, you know, introduce them to the topic and reintroduce them to the topic and maintain that, you know, every couple of years we just have to go back and go talk to them again and say, here's what we do, here's why we do it, here's how it benefits humanity and society or whatever it is, you know, whatever arguments you need to make. So you know, not only get legal involved early, but get them involved often, I guess is the point there. Yeah, many vendors get it, some don't. And we've still seen that, you know, it is hard for people to come around to the idea, if they haven't thought about it before, that vulnerabilities in their products being disclosed would make it better for both their users and for them in the long run. And it's a difficult conversation to have with people, but we've gotten a lot of vendors over that concern. And we also will frequently wind up when we're coordinating vulnerabilities with researchers, and especially when it's novel vendors or multiple vendors, you know, the complexities of those things, like knowing who to report to and knowing that some organizations don't respond as quickly as others or some respond better. We've done a couple interesting things where if we know that vendor A's product, vendor A puts out a library and they've got a vulnerability in that, and they're not really responding well enough, well, we might contact vendor B, who we know uses that library, and say, hey, you're a big customer of theirs. We're not, but you should go talk to your suppliers and get some leverage on that. So that's one thing that anybody could do. And the other thing that we've done is, you know, there were some vulnerabilities, I think, presented at Black Hat a couple weeks ago that we had coordinated on. And there were, in the early conversations, when the researchers contacted us and said they're going to be releasing this at Black Hat, the vendor gets on the phone, and their first conference call, they've got their lawyers on the line. And so part of what we did was, you know, we can help defuse some of that situation in the background. And it's not, you know, the lawyer threatening a student is one thing. The lawyer threatening the CERT Coordination Center and the student, that's a harder argument for them to make, because we carry a little bit more weight in some of those conversations. So, you know, sometimes if you need that third party neutrality and some leverage there, you know, you can still send email to cert@cert.org. We will help. That's what we're there for. So,
cool. I'm Alex Halderman from the University of Michigan. I think we heard a lot of very interesting and helpful perspectives in the last few minutes, including really great advice about how to proceed with disclosures, working through CERT, working through your university's council, and so forth. Sometimes, though, there are extreme cases where these things aren't necessarily possible. And I wanted to give you an anecdote about an experience I had about 2 years ago doing research again in voting that I think shows you that there are some limits and sometimes when you have to get creative. This was a project where I was looking at the security of the electronic voting system they used nationwide in India, which had some relatively severe procedural problems that would allow the hardware to be tampered with and potentially elections to be stolen. But the government's official position was that there were no problems whatsoever, that the system was perfect, and by the way, nobody was allowed to look at the machines and prove otherwise. So this wasn't really a situation where the people in charge, the vendor of the product, didn't know about the problems. They knew all the facts. They knew the same facts we did. But there was a disagreement and a case where it was really something where the public and policymakers would need to make a decision about how the technology should be secured. And so the project I was involved in involved a government whistleblower who provided a voting machine to a team of researchers that included people in India and people from my group at Michigan. We studied the machine. We wrote a CCS paper about it, CCS 2011, I guess. And one of my co-authors in India went on national television in India and did a live demonstration of how you could tamper with the machine. The government's reaction was first to deny that it was a real machine, then to say that it was a real machine, but the problems were not as severe as they were saying. And by the way, the real machine was stolen. It was then to arrest my co-author and keep him without a lawyer for a couple of weeks, being interrogated by the police. Eventually, though, everything worked out. For him, for me, he eventually came before a judge who said they should be focusing on the problems and not on the provenance of the machine, that this man, if he's correct, has done a service for his country. They later tried to deport me from India when I returned to talk about solving the problems with the election officials, but by that time they wanted to talk to me, so we got me in. Eventually, and today, they've listened to us, and they've actually are working on rolling out machines that correct the problems and add a paper trail. But it was not an easy process. And the ethical answers to the questions like, should you work with an anonymous source under these circumstances? Should we be going public with problems like this that have implications for the democratic process? Were not at all easy and not at all clear. And this was a case where there really were not resources available to help us answer those questions, where we had to very much be figuring things out as we went along. But the risks are there. Sometimes, though, the implications and the outcomes are so important that you have to figure them out and follow your ethical guidance, follow the guidance of people who have more experience than you do, and be creative for the good. So that's the story.
Okay, so we are almost out of time. So let's see. Boy, that went fast, huh? Do we have a couple last short remarks that anybody wants to make?
I'd like to speak very quickly in favor of getting involved in the policymaking process.
Yes.
The laws that affect us here, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the U.S., these are changeable. There is action going on. There's folks at EFF. There's folks over here from Public Knowledge. Please raise your hands if you're interested in talking to them about the DMCA. Please do. ACM is another group that's involved in all of this. We need to speak up and make sure that policymakers understand the value of what we do and the way that these laws can hold us back.
My name is Sherwin C. I'm a lawyer at Public Knowledge. Just wanted to echo that. If you have particular stories of running into problems with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, please come talk to us. We can't represent you, but we can help try and change the conversation around that. I'm sure Kurt also would very much like to be talking to you about those things too.
Yes, please do.
You forgot the IEEE? Yes, thank you. And the thing I would ask is, do you think it's possible to produce a professional organizational document that says, these are generally our guidelines? Because there's agreement in this room, but if upon first contact, instead of just saying, look, we all know this, to have a document that you can point to that says, we all know this, and I am following a documented best practices, and that you can, you know, that students and independent consultants can see. And I think any of the professional organizations, including USENIX, would do a service. The only one that's out there is the 2001 IETF best practice for vulnerability disclosures, and that is very PC-centric. I mean, it assumes patch cycles, and it's totally outdated. So I'm going to appeal to Dan to write up a best practices document.
So I'm Margaret Seltzer. Being on the faculty at Harvard, I'm the USENIX board president, and I just want to say that one of the little to-dos I had jotted down in this section was very much in the spirit of what you're suggesting. I think the community needs it. It seems like a fine thing for USENIX to become involved in. The other thing, I'll put in a small plug, the CCC, the Computing Community Consortium, holds an event called LISPI, which is essentially, it's a boot camp for how to talk to your policymakers and government officials. And it's if you want to be involved in this space, that's a great first step, is to apply to that and actually get some training in how to do that.
We're out of time? All right, thank you all very much.
All right, thank you.